Hello, and welcome to the November IASB Update Podcast. I am Neely Shaw, the Executive Technical Director at the IASB, and as always, I am here with the Chair of the IASB, Andreas Barco. Thank you for joining us, Andreas.
Thanks for having me, Neely.
So today, as always, we will run through the highlights from our November IASB meeting. There will be quite a few topics for us to cover today, one of which is the highly anticipated vote on the accounting for goodwill. So this is the age-old question about whether or not to amortize goodwill. Andreas, could you start us off by letting us know how that IASB discussion went?
My pleasure, Neely. If you follow our projects closely, you will know that this month's IASB's discussion on whether to retain the impairment-only model or to explore reintroducing amortization of goodwill is one of the key decisions for this project. Let me start by saying that we are very grateful to our stakeholders for the time they've spent on this topic and the information they have provided us to enable the IASB to make this decision. And several IASB members noted there wasn't any more evidence they could have been asked for. So arguably, we had a solid basis for our decision making. It is important to note that the IASB was asked whether sufficient evidence has been gathered to provide a compelling case for changing the existing requirements, that is, the impairment-only approach. It was not asked whether they preferred an impairment-only or an amortization model, as if the requirements were being introduced for the first time. And I think that's very important to highlight. A number of IASB members who generally preferred an amortization-based model, in fact, did vote to retain the impairment-only model because in their view, there was not a compelling case for change. Many IASB members during the discussion acknowledged that maintaining convergence between IFRS 3 and the US GAAP equivalent was important. And many members thought that the package of disclosures the IASB had discussed and tentatively decided upon in September is the area of the project where the IASB could achieve the biggest improvement in financial reporting. So considering all the evidence, the IASB concluded that there was insufficient evidence of a compelling case for change. We will therefore proceed with the preliminary review set out in the 2020 discussion paper, which is to retain the impairment-only model for the subsequent accounting of goodwill. Having made this decision, the IASB is expected to decide next month whether to move the project from its research phase to a standard-setting phase, meaning that we will now progress towards an exposure draft. So stay tuned for that.
Exciting stuff. Thank you, Andreas. This is no doubt one of the most significant decision-making points in November. Let's move on to our maintenance projects next. And I'll start with a new project aimed at providing relief from accounting implications of an international tax reform, the so-called OECD's Pillar 2 model rules. And for those people who aren't too familiar with what that is, let me briefly explain a little bit more about that. For a long time, the OECD has looked into harmonizing income taxes globally and tackling profit shifting by companies towards so-called low-tax environments. Last year, G20 leaders agreed in principle to the two main pillars of the project. Pillar 1 is aimed at defining what gets taxed, so the basis, and Pillar 2 is aimed at defining which jurisdictions get how much of the cake. Here, the aim was to ensure that large multinational companies pay a minimum amount of tax on income arising in each jurisdiction in which they operate. The rules require a company to pay a so-called top-up tax when the tax it has paid in jurisdictions represent less than the global minimum tax rate of 15% of its profits in that jurisdiction. So, what is the IASB doing? In November, the IASB discussed the potential effects of the implementation of the Pillar 2 model rules on the accounting for income taxes under IAS 12. In particular, IASB members considered the concerns heard from stakeholders about how to account for deferred taxes that could arise when the rules are implemented. Following that discussion, the IASB agreed to add an accelerated standard setting project to its work plan because the rules are expected to be enacted in some jurisdictions as soon as the first half of 2023. The IASB also tentatively decided to propose a temporary exception from the requirement in IAS 12 to account for deferred taxes arising from the Pillar 2 rules. And finally, the board tentatively decided to introduce targeted disclosure requirements for affected companies to provide users with the signaling and a starting point for their assessments. Andreas, could you add some more color to the disclosure decisions?
Sure. The ISB spent quite some time discussing what would be the basis and would be appropriate to ask companies to disclose, particularly in those periods where the rules have been enacted but have not yet taken effect. ISB members all agreed that information about tax is important to investors and that companies should provide some information in the period between the enactment and the effective date. The objective is to provide investors with a starting point, as you say, to assess an entity's potential exposure in having to pay top-up taxes. But what is challenging is to balance costs and benefits. What could companies reasonably be expected to provide that would give investors some useful information? Because it is, I wouldn't say speculative, but it's highly uncertain. The ISB tentatively decided that companies would be required to disclose information about the legislation enacted or substantively enacted to implement the Pillar 2 rules and jurisdictions in which a company's effective tax rate in the current period, that's calculated based on the existing requirements in IAS 12, is below 15% as a proxy. The board also proposes to require disclosure of the company's accounting profit, income tax expense, and weighted average tax rate in these jurisdictions, but in aggregate. We will be particularly interested in the feedback on this aspect of the proposed disclosure requirements. The ISB also proposed some disclosures on an ongoing basis. That is, companies would be required to disclose that they have applied the temporary exception and that their current tax expense related to Pillar Top-Up 2 taxes.
Thanks, Andreas. In terms of next steps, this is an accelerated narrow scope amendment to IAS 12, which means that we expect to publish an exposure draft very soon, likely in early January 2023. It is also important to highlight that because of the accelerated nature of the project, the exposure draft will have a shorter comment period of 60 days. If you'd like to contribute to our decision-making, please do make sure you share your feedback by the comment letter deadline. Now let's move on to another maintenance project on supplier finance arrangements. This project is exploring adding disclosure requirements to IAS 7, Statement of Cash Flows, and IFRS 7 on financial instruments disclosures. To help users understand the effects of supplier finance arrangements on a company's debt, cash flows, and exposure to liquidity risk. As some of you may recall, in July, the ISB discussed feedback on its exposure draft on this topic. In November, the ISB concluded the bulk of its decisions about this project. Andreas, could you share the highlights?
Of course. This month, the ISB decided to retain its current approach for the project to be a disclosure-only project. We also decided to proceed with adding disclosure requirements about supplier finance arrangements to IFRS accounting standards. Based on the feedback received, the ISB retained the majority of the proposed disclosures, but decided to provide clarifications to the scope, the disclosure objective, and presentation of financial liabilities that are part of those arrangements. The board also simplified the level of collective information. Perhaps worthy extra mention, on the disclosure of the amount of financial liabilities that finance providers have already paid to suppliers, the board decided to retain the proposal. The ISB will discuss transition and effective date in a future meeting and expects to issue final amendments in the second quarter of 2023.
Let's move on to financial instruments. This month, the ISB discussed and made big milestone decisions on the post-implementation review of IFRS 9 on classification and measurement and the amendment that came out of it. So starting with the post-implementation review, with this project, the ISB decided not to take further action on the feedback relating to requirements for classification and measurement of financial liabilities and the presentation of changes in a company's own credit risk, because feedback on the request for information indicated that there is no fundamental question about the clarity and suitability of those requirements in IFRS 9. Following that discussion, the ISB decided that adequate work had been completed to conclude the post-implementation review. This means that the ISB's focus has now shifted towards publishing a project report and feedback statement on the PIR, which is expected to be published by the end of the year. As a result of this PIR, the ISB also plans to publish an exposure draft to propose some narrow scope amendments to the classification and measurement requirements in IFRS 9. Andreas, can you share some developments on that project?
Of course. This narrow scope project is exploring three matters. First and foremost, clarification of the requirements for assessing the contractual cash flow characteristics of financial assets, including so-called ESG-linked financial assets and contractually linked instruments. These issues were discussed in July and September. And let me emphasize again, these are meant to be clarifications, not changes to our literature. Second, disclosure about the performance of equity instruments to which the other comprehensive income presentation option is applied. The board discussed this issue in October. And third, amendments related to the settlement of financial liabilities through electronic cash transfers. In November, the ISB concluded its discussions on these matters. I would like to spend a few words on the third area, if that's okay, Neely. Regular listeners will recall that the Interpretations Committee voted in June to finalize a tentative agenda decision on electronic cash transfers. At the same time, the committee decided to report to the board the feedback it received on the issue. In September, the ISB considered the feedback and decided to explore whether it could provide relief for a particular type of electronic settlements without compromising the information provided to investors. In November, staff proposed, and the ISB tentatively agreed, that entities should be given an accounting policy choice to derecognize the financial liability before the settlement date on electronic payment systems, provided certain criteria are met. And these are: the company does not have the ability to withdraw, stop, or cancel an electronic payment instruction. The company has lost the practical ability to access the cash as a result of the electronic payment instruction. The settlement risk associated with the electronic payment instruction is insignificant. And to facilitate application, the ISB will also set out the payment system criteria for when settlement risk is considered insignificant. The next step for this project is to publish an exposure draft. The ISB has agreed on a comment period of 120 days for the exposure draft. If, after publication of this exposure draft and redeliberation of feedback, the ISB finalizes these proposals, there will be no need for the Interpretations Committee's tentative agenda decision. So the ISB will consider the status of the tentative decision at that time.
Thanks, Andreas. So that concludes all of the big milestone decisions that the ISB made in November. Let me share a couple of quick updates on some of the other projects that were discussed. First, the ISB had an education session on its project on business combinations under common control. An education session means that the board shared views on a technical topic, but it did not make any decisions. And specifically in November, the ISB discussed the measurement methods that receiving companies of a transaction of a business combination under control would apply to that transaction. So is it the acquisition method or the book value method? Secondly, the board made some decisions to progress the subsidiaries without public accountability disclosures project. The ISB wrapped up its deliberation on the scope of the proposed accounting standard this month. And in particular, it decided to confirm that to apply the proposed standard, a company has to be a subsidiary at the end of the reporting period and has an ultimate or intermediate parent that produces consolidated financial statements available for public use that comply with IFRS accounting standards. Third, on the dynamic risk management project, the ISB discussion focused on determining a company's current net open risk position. First, the ISB tentatively decided that the inclusion of equity is not necessary, and therefore equity is not an eligible item for the purposes of the DRM model. And secondly, the ISB tentatively decided that notional alignment is not required between the designated assets and liabilities. And then finally, on the rate regulated activities project, this month, the ISB made some decisions about the accounting for regulatory returns on an asset not yet available for use when a company capitalizes borrowing costs to construct that asset. The ISB discussed the implications of applying its previous tentative decision on such regulatory returns in this situation.
So before we conclude, I wanted to give a quick update on our primary financial statements project, if that's okay. Our listeners may recall that this team had been regularly coming to the board table every month for the past year and a half, but we haven't seen them since September. Not to worry, don't push the panic button. Everyone is fine, but we are working hard in the background. In September, the IASB made the last of its significant decisions in this project. Since then, the team has been conducting outreach to hear feedback on board decisions that are different from the exposure draft. Expect they will be back at the board table in January with a summary of the feedback from its outreach. Depending on this feedback, we expect to have a better sense of when the new IFRS accounting standard for this project will be issued. What we can tell you right now is that although everyone is working expeditiously, in light of the remaining decisions that need to be made, as well as the drafting and balloting process, we do not expect the new standard to be issued in 2023.
Thanks, Andreas. Before we conclude this month's podcast, I wanted to flag for our listeners that the IASB on the 31st of October issued an amendment to IAS 1 on the presentation of financial statements. The narrow scope amendment to IAS 1 is expected to improve information a company provides about long-term debt with covenants by enabling investors to understand the risk that such debt could come due. And like most things discussed, more information about this amendment is available on our website. So that brings us to the end of our November podcast. As ever, you can catch up on previous episodes of this and the IFRS Interpretations Committee on our website, as well as our YouTube channel and Spotify. For the latest developments, make sure to subscribe on our website. And if you like this podcast, please do take some time to rate, review, and subscribe on your preferred podcast player. Remember to tune in next month for the next installment. Thank you very much.